welcome everybody to our first presentation for this year. To kick the commemorations off this year, well, you'll note that our program tries to focus on commemorative anniversaries, if you like. And so there are a series of 80th anniversaries coming up this year. And of course, the first cab off the rank is the 80th anniversary of the surrender of Singapore. And I won't steal any more thunder out of the presentation for today. For those of you that attended Richard's Singapore Strategy Stage 1 last year, was it, Richard?
Yes.
That's so long ago. it was quite an interesting presentation on the lead-up to World War II over an extensive period where Britain wanted to establish a naval centre out of Singapore between World War I and World War II. So I guess without further ado, could we all please welcome retired Commander Richard Jackson, Royal New Zealand Navy, who has come all the way over from the sunny Wairarapa to give the presentation. So welcome, Richard.
All right, good afternoon. Thank you, everybody. Firstly, of course, current events have a way of kind of echoing things, and I was struck in the last few days as I was reading up and doing my preparations about the Malayan campaign and the fall of Singapore, is that at this very moment the Western nations are providing arms to an Eastern nation on the, quote, Eastern Front, depending on what Vladimir Putin does, so there's a war scare in the air. And the other thing, as you're all aware of, with COVID, we're in this state of tension as to how far it's going to spread and how quickly it's going to spread, and that sort of thing. And you will particularly remember, of course, in 2020, when January, this odd disease from China turned up, people in Italy started dying, and then the next thing, we're all in lockdown. And my point there is the pace of events. And so when you go back to December 1941, it's this whole issue of the pace of events, the uncertainty underlying just what might happen, and then when things unfold, they unfold it very rapidly. So, and I guess it's not a spoiler alert, because you all know how this ends, sadly. So there we are with a victorious Japanese unit marching somewhere, displaying a rising sun flag. Now, Japan's war plan was extraordinary. I'm trusting that you're reasonably familiar with the general background. Britain at war with Germany, Germany invading Soviet Union. The Japanese had a bloody nose from the Soviet Union a couple of years earlier. All this leads to and the Americans had imposed sanctions on oil, and this leads to a decision to go south and take what they called the Southern Resources Area, namely the Netherlands East Indies, so today's Indonesia. So what they're after is oil, tin, rubber, other resources, food as well, to fuel their ongoing and more important campaign in China. And so they put their heads together and do a lot of extensive planning, and they come up with the primary aim that they will march south in parallel through Malaya to Sumatra to eventually get Java, through the Philippines, through the east of Indonesia, and eventually get to Java, and that way create their southern resources area. So it was an ambitious plan, and it was planned in great detail. What we're concerned with today is Malaya and Singapore, which is really a subset of this much larger campaign. And you can see how ambitious it is. Striking everywhere at once, really, would be a way to describe it. But the two key thrusts are into Malaya and into the Philippines. And of course, the role of the Pearl Harbor strike is merely to protect their flank, to prevent the US Navy from intervening in the operations that are carrying on in the Philippines and the Malaya area. So Pearl Harbor is just, the flank attack and not the main thrust of the whole thing. And so this is what their goal looks like. And you'll be familiar with this map. all the way from Burma through the Netherlands, East Indies, New Guinea to the Gilbert Islands, and then, occupying that area and obviously defending it against any subsequent Allied counterattack. And also somewhat convinced that if they strike a really harsh blow against the Americans, this will probably make them sit down and talk about peace, the soft Americans. And so imagine if you're the officer on duty in Imperial General Headquarters, Tokyo, at midnight on the beginning of the 8th of December. You're going to have a very busy night as all these reports come in. And the first thing that happens on the 8th of December is that an airstrike from the Saigon airfields directed at Singapore fails because of the weather. In the meantime, the big convoys that have gone into the Gulf of Thailand are coming around off the beaches of Malaya and Thailand. And simultaneously, but 4 hours ahead in time, not in date, but in time, on the decks of six aircraft carriers off Hawaii, the Japanese Navy is arming, fueling, and warming up aircraft for a major strike at Pearl Harbor. And so as the sequence of events unfolds, the fighting begins at Kota Baru in northern Malaya, roughly half an hour to an hour ahead of the airstrike at Pearl Harbor. And then as dawn sweeps across the Pacific, air raids occur. The air raid gets through, a second attempt gets through to Singapore, and at 4 in the morning, Singapore time, because Singapore is an hour and a half behind Tokyo. So 4 in the morning, there's a successful air raid on Singapore, which upsets the Brits because they didn't think Japanese aircraft had that range. And similarly, the American possessions of Wake Island and Guam are attacked. As dawn comes to Hong Kong, it too is attacked. And the only thing that actually goes wrong for the Japanese is this fog over the airfields on Formosa, Taiwan. And so it's not until 12 midday that the big nearly 200 aircraft strike reaches the American airfields in the vicinity of Manila and basically wipes out General MacArthur's Air Force. This is not today's talk, but you'll notice there's a long delay between 12 midday on the 8th of December and 4 a.m. when Pearl Harbor starts to unfold, and there are huge questions that need to be asked about why General MacArthur failed to properly prepare for the assault in that time. But that's not today's talk. Key thing is the Japanese are striking everywhere at once, with surprise and basically overwhelming the Allied positions. So a quick look at Malaya. And Malaya is about the size of the South Island. So if you think of Blenheim and Nelson at the north end, and Singapore, obviously, where Stewart Island is, that's the size of Kampang, or the territory they'll be fighting over. Points to note are on the top right, you may see the point of Kota Baru, right by the Thai border, and that's where the first Japanese landing took place. Further north in Thailand itself are Singora and Patani, and not only did Japanese landings take place there, but there were airfields there. The Japanese, with good intelligence, flew aircraft into those airfields that very the moment it was daylight that day. The centre of Malaya is, as you can see, rough hill country, a lot of jungle, not very easy to campaign in, and so the main campaign would be along the main lines of communication down the west coast, where the rail lines are marked on this map, but rail and road was relatively good all the way down to Singapore. The east coast, not so much, and that was not the main thrust on the east side. On the other point I should make, of course, December is when the monsoon is starting, so every day has got heavy, intensive rain. Now, because we're in New Zealand, often this campaign seems a bit remote because 2NZEF wasn't directly involved. But there was, in fact, a New Zealand contribution. In addition to the £1 million we spent on helping pay for the naval base, and you can see the Air Force had a major part of it. It's estimated about 600 RNZAF personnel were involved, and although there's only one named RNZAF squadron, 488 squadron, which we'll talk about, there were New Zealand aircrew in pretty much most of the other RAF squadrons there. The aerodrome construction squadron I'll talk a little bit about, and the Hush Hush Boys, there's a rather nice little essay on the Air Force Museum site, and I had a chat with the Simon and Matthew, the Air Force Museum staffers, about this. The RAF in the 1941 period, as it was expanding, realised it needed more officers for those essential but humdrum administrative tasks and into the intelligence field, and they were realising with radar being installed they needed what were effectively air traffic controllers, fighter directors. And so 28 young New Zealanders were selected, some not so young, for their administrative qualities, I guess, sent over there and dispersed amongst RAF ground units, RAF stations. And amazingly, all 28 of them survived the campaign. Not so lucky, the 32 young New Zealand officers and yachtsmen, or rather yachtsmen selected to be officers and sent off to join the Royal Navy units in Malaya. Ultimately 32 went, and of those, I think the figure is 14 are killed and several become prisoners of war. And in the Royal New Zealand Navy's official history, it's estimated about 100 New Zealanders in the Navy were involved in the campaign. And I note, for example, the cruiser Exeter had 10 New Zealanders specifically, almost all of whom were signallers. So there is a New Zealand connection, and obviously there's a very strong Australian connection, as will become apparent, and India, which was, of course, the crown jewel of the British Empire, was heavily involved as well. And so I'm going to make this talk in three parts: Navy, Air Force, and Army. I'm very aware that the Army campaign is the heart of the Malayan campaign, but on the one hand, it's well known. On the other hand, we've got limited time, and I really wanted to highlight these other factors because I was surprised by some of the things I came across. This, incidentally, is a painting of Repulse, the battlecruiser that was sunk, but a rather nice painting. The Japanese, notwithstanding that their six large carriers with suitable escorts were off Pearl Harbor, most of the Japanese Navy was involved in the operation for the Southern Resources Area. And so in the South China Sea in particular, and covering the landings at Malaya, were two battleships, which had been modernized in the 30s, eight heavy cruisers, the light cruiser, and you can see the rest there. At the airfields in Saigon, they had a large naval air group of the torpedo bombers, supported by a few fighters. Most of my talking about aircraft will be about the Japanese Army Air Force, but obviously the Japanese Naval Air Force played a part, but in the end, not a significant part. However, they did, as you know, without any surprise, sink Prince of Wales and Repulse. This is a Japanese photo, pretty clearly. Repulse is at the top. The first bombs have been dropped from high level, and one of them has hit her. So this is actually the very opening salvo, as it were, of the campaign. The other point I'd like to make about Prince of Wales and Repulse is that had they met the Japanese naval surface forces, I feel that they would have been defeated and sunk anyway. The Allies did not know about the Long Lance torpedo. You saw there were eight heavy cruisers there in the Japanese order of battle, all of them armed with the Long Lance torpedo. In a night engagement, I suspect that Prince of Wales and Repulse might well have taken somebody with them, but they probably would have not survived a surface encounter. And so kind of a summary of just the involvement of the navies, because it didn't end with the sinking of Prince of Wales and Repulse, although that was a huge blow for everybody's morale in Malaya and Singapore. The primary role of the Royal Navy then became running convoys into Singapore, and in January and early February there are 8 convoys there, all extensively, there are a lot of ships involved there, 13 cruisers, but again, had these met Japanese ships in surface combat, almost all of them would have been defeated, because most of them were World War I survivors, I guess would be the phrase. I might just note that the Glasgow, which was a very modern cruiser, had in fact been damaged by Italian aerial torpedoes in 1941, just before the Crete campaign. She couldn't be repaired at Alexandria, was sent from the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean to Singapore, where the brand new dockyard, couldn't repair her either. So she was completing this campaign on 2 or possibly 3 of the 4 propeller shafts, capable of only 24 knots. So she was not a fully efficient fighting ship, although her armament was good. So in essence, these ships that were in the Indian Ocean and Southeast Asia area were very much a second 11. And the one exception I'd remark on is at the bottom there, I've remarked on 2 Indian sloops as well as an Australian one. The 2 Indian sloops were in fact the most modern ships of this entire collection. They were the Black Swan class, built only about a year before, very good anti-aircraft ships. So it just underlines that notwithstanding that the British and the Empire were trying to rearm, they were still very much the second 11. And a small note about the British carriers. Why weren't the British carriers? Firstly, HMS Hermes was the first carrier designed and built as such, could carry 12 aircraft. She was under refit in this period in South Africa, so she was out of the picture. Indomitable, a brand new carrier, was supposed to deploy with Prince of Wales and Repulse. On her workup, she ran aground in Jamaica. When I was a sub-lieutenant on course in the UK, undergoing navigational training at HMS Dryad, they teach the indomitable grounding as one of the reasons why your navigation needs to be accurate. So indomitable is memorable for the wrong reasons. It's still before the war for the Americans, they're neutral, but under their lease provisions, they were indomitable in hand, repaired her. She raced to South Africa and was there in December when the war broke out. Because of the way events unfolded, it was decided to use her as an aircraft transport, and she essentially made 2 missions, and you'll see there, one in which she flew off hurricanes to, in fact, she flew them off to either Sumatra or Java before they got to Singapore, and the other mission was to supply hurricanes to Ceylon. So Indomitable was not available as an aircraft carrier, nor was that the sort of competition she would face at that point. And here are the 8 convoys. And the key point here is how important Bombay and India is to the support of Malaya. The convoy from Sydney was in fact the troopship Aquitania. So it was not a large convoy, but one very important ship. Got as far as Java, and she was too valuable to go closer, so her troops were transshipped into smaller ships and taken into Singapore. As we can discuss later, one of the complaints of the Australian Imperial Force is that those particular reinforcements were barely off the street into camp, given a uniform, and some of them, they claim, hardly knew how to fire a rifle. But if nothing else, this indicates that the Brits made every effort to reinforce Singapore. The sad thing is, it was mostly too late. And if some of you remember the passenger liner Australis, that was an Australia-New Zealand run for many years back in the 70s, I think through to the 80s. She was in fact the former SS America, which had been taken up by the US government in 1941 before the war broke out for the Americans. Painted grey and used as a troop ship, and she was one of the ships that carried the 18th British Division to Singapore. This particular drawing is made by an Australian chap who became a prisoner of war and somehow was able to secrete his sketchbook, and it survived the war. So the naval side, the focus is running convoys into Singapore. The air side, a bit more problematic here. Now, these are Brewster Buffalo fighters, and you may well have all heard of the inadequacies of the Brewster Buffalo. But this was a pre-war shot when they formed into a nice formation and overflew Singapore. And on this map, you'll see the little RAF roundels showing eight airfields in Malaya. This particular map doesn't show the four airfields in Singapore. And while the map is designed with the dates and the red oblongs that you can see, the key point for me is the airfields. So they're either up north, at Alor Star, Sungai Petani and Butterworth, over on the east coast at Kota Baru. There's another airfield near there that we'll touch on later. A few airfields in the middle of the country, and then down in Johor at Kluang, it shows just the one, and there was another airfield that our aerodrome construction squadron actually did complete, but not in time to be of use to the RAF. The other point to make about the RAF, I mean, they learned lessons from the Battle of Britain, so they knew radar was a good thing to have. And the other thing that is often overlooked in the context of the Battle of Britain is the Observer Corps, who, because if you recall, the British air radars in 1940 only looked out to sea. They did not work well over land in 1940. And so the Observer Corps was a very important part of keeping track of German formations in the Battle of Britain. Now, the point here is that it was very much harder to make an equivalent Observer Corps in Malaya. Firstly, proportionately, there are that many less British citizens. Secondly, can you convince Malays and Chinese to actually sit down and learn aircraft types? And thirdly, is the phone system good enough? And fourthly, it's a big country and they're very much spread out. So there was not the same Observer Corps support for the fighter controllers. But nonetheless, the British were installing a radar. They installed one at Mersing, which is down at the bottom right, just on the east coast. And in fact, from some of my reading, it appears there may well have been two radars within a short distance of each other. And there were two or three radars on Singapore Island, with, as I say there, Seletar, one of the airfields, as the air defence operations room. Now, this is courtesy of the New Zealand official, RNZAF official history. I don't expect you to memorise it all. The point being that they did have 158 aircraft at the time, and they're pretty much spread out in penny packets, as you can see. The top three airfields are the Singapore ones, with Kallang being the airfield associated with 488 Squadron. Sungai Petani, we touched on the northeast. It also had a night fighter airfield. So, and I'm presuming with the Blenheim ones that they were in a night fighter role because they presumably had air intercept radar. But I haven't seen any sort of concrete source to confirm that. But radar was accessible, just being installed, still new. But nonetheless, the Blenheims were dedicated night fighters, therefore I suspect they did have it. There's an airfield of Gong Kedah, which is up near Kota Baru. It was a small one, had a detachment of the Wildebeest torpedo bombers. We'll talk through them. So the point is, quite a lot of airfields, the various alternative airfields as well, and 158 aircraft. And we'll go through the types right now. So firstly, Brewster Buffalo, a couple of Kiwis in front of it. You can see that the ground's wet because it's the monsoon and it rains pretty much every day and heavily. Brewster Buffalo was built to an American Navy specification. Its counterpart was the Grumman Wildcat, you hopefully have heard of, which was a much more successful naval fighter. The Buffalo was available, the assembly line was functioning, the Dutch had ordered a lot, and so Java, there are a lot of rest of Buffaloes. And apparently, according to the accounts, and I did, before he passed away, meet Vic Barge, a Masterton-based man who flew here. He flew mostly over Burma. The Buffalo was a delightful aircraft to fly. It was just a bloody awful combat aircraft. The Hudson Bomber, this is one of the Australian squadrons. And the Hudson, as you might know, was the Lockheed Electra pre-war airliner. And the British went to Lockheed and said, can you help us? And they said, we'll turn this into a bomber for you. One of the team working on the design of converting a civil airliner to a bomber was Kelly Johnson, who later became responsible for the U-2 and the SR-71 strategic reconnaissance aircraft. So the young Kelly Johnson put some of his talent into the Hudson. And as you know, ultimately it was quite a successful aircraft through the war. This is the Blenheim 1, so it's got a very short nose, radial engines, and a crew of 3 or 4. And this is the Blenheim Mark IV, which had a longer nose, more powerful engines, and that was being delivered to the Air Force in Malaya at the time that the war broke out. Then this is the Wildebeest, 1934-35, 100-mile-an-hour torpedo bomber. Back in 1934, it was probably quite good, not exactly state-of-the-art, but quite good, but the damn thing was still in service in 1941. There were 2 squadrons there, some with New Zealanders amongst them. And this is a photograph of one of the Hurricanes that was delivered in crates, assembled and issued to the squadrons, this particular one, the 488 squadron. And the Dutch played their part in the air defence of Malaya and Singapore. They not only had Buffalo fighters, which were sent to Singapore, they had these Martin B-10 bombers. This one, this photo, it's in American markings. The Martin B-10 of 1932 was a pretty impressive aircraft in its day, and it was still in service with the US Army Air Corps in 1941, and the Dutch had it, and obviously it became, in American service, reverted to training roles very, very quickly. But you can see that for its time, it was probably quite a modern bomber, and the Dutch very gallantly flew them on our behalf in Malaya and Singapore, as well as, of course, in the defence of Java. And here's our aerodrome construction squadron. Tibrau is just north of the Johor Strait, so in Johor province, and not all that far from Singapore. They were building, I think they were 1,200-yard strips, yard-long strips, with packed shingle. They didn't concrete them. And at the time that they completed the Tibrau strip, the retreat had gained such momentum, they were told to drag trees across the runway and to dig holes so that the engineers could put mines in them and blow up the runways. Quite unsatisfying for the aerodrome construction squadron. In contrast, the Japanese have got twice the number of aircraft. Now these are, as I say, these are the Japanese Army aircraft, so I won't really touch on the Japanese Navy. And which means we don't talk about the Zero. There's a lot of myths about the Zero, but not many of them are involved in the Malayan campaign. The fighter of concern is the Ki-43 Oscar. And the Allied code names, you're probably familiar with them. The Allied code names were dreamed up in the late 1942 by the US Army Air Force by some of their Australian staff, when they realised that firstly the Japanese designations were a bit too complex and unwieldy. You're on a radio in a fighter in combat, the last thing you need to do is remember Ki-43. And so the deal with the Allied code names is that the boys' names are for fighters girls' names are for bombers, girls' names also for the reconnaissance aircraft, and I'm not sure what the category was for transport aircraft, but they obviously they had a pattern for them. But the key one is fighters are boys and bombers are girls. And so this is the Oscar. The Oscar came into service after the Zero. It was not widely known, and it looks a lot like a Zero. It's got a radial engine, bubble canopy, different shape to the tail, and it's a surprisingly lightly armed fighter. It had the same faults as a Zero, not much armour plating, a relatively low powered engine, so they made a very light aircraft, and so it was vulnerable to Allied fire, to being hit. It also had an armament of only two machine guns, but their pilots were well trained, would fly up close, and would, once they were up close behind you, they would really miss. So the Oscar was quite deadly. It continued in service in various modifications throughout the war. Now this is the NAIT, and the NAIT preceded the Oscar, obviously, but was still in service, and as you can see, it's got a fixed wing, a fixed undercarriage. You'll see several of these aircraft have fixed undercarriages, and I think that probably contributed to the underestimation of the Japanese Air Force. And incidentally, the Navy's Claude fighter, which preceded the Zero, looked very similar, also with a fixed undercarriage. The Lily bomber. Now, I've put up to the right in black there the kind of equivalent Allied aircraft, just if it will help you put the aircraft into perspective. So I'm hoping that those names won't bewilder you. The Sally, which was probably their best bomber. And there were two aircraft that were basically close support aircraft. They weren't specialist dive bombers, but they carried bombs and were there to support the army, because the Japanese Army Air Force, of course, worked for the army. So there was the Anne and the Sonya, both very similar roles, slightly different in some of their details and weapon load, but these were the aircraft that would be mostly harassing the British troops day after day. This is the Dyna, very recent aircraft in Japanese service, fast, high performance, high altitude, intended as a reconnaissance aircraft. Obviously this is a painting, but you'll notice the tail insignia. So there were a few of these, and these would fly over Singapore reputedly. A number of them did reconnaissance missions before war broke out. Babs was really a communication aircraft. Those of you who might remember the Osters of number 3 Battlefield Support Squadron. So Babs was could carry several passengers. I don't think it had a particular armament. It wasn't used for attack purposes, but it was, however, used for tactical reconnaissance. Now, on this slide, I try to summarise the air campaign. So for 2 months, 158 Allied aircraft with some reinforcements battled against the Japanese Army Air Service over Malaya. And the Japanese kept their campaign closely focused on where the British front line was. Singapore itself was only bombed 3 times in December, so it wasn't until January that they actually settled down to bombing Singapore on a daily basis. The first attacks, of course, on the morning of the 8th and through on the 9th were very effective, destroyed roughly half Allied of British air strength, and it was within 3 days that the air marshals pulled the RAF out of the northern airfields. There is one VC that was won posthumously by Squadron Leader Scarf, who led a raid of Blenheims onto Singora, the Thai airfield. Most of the aircraft were shot down or bombed on takeoff. He got away safely. He was the only aircraft to actually get to the target, drop his bombs and get back. Badly shot up, he crashed, his aircraft crashed just before the airfield, and he, with the rest of his crew dead, was taken to the hospital where, ironically, his wife worked as a nurse. So she was beside him as he died. not a happy thought. However, he clearly earned his VC. And so the RAF retreated to central Malaya relatively early in the campaign, and things on the ground, as we'll talk, unfolded very quickly. And then in January, the Japanese were in position for the daily bombing of Singapore, and that continued with some intensity for the rest of the campaign. It isn't until the 20th of January that those cratered hurricanes reassembled and get into action. And ironically, that was the handling of the crates, of 50 hurricanes in crates, fairly, you know, kind of like a container. That was one of the more slick things the Brits did. They were offloaded quickly, they were dispersed, they had teams of mechanics ready to assemble them, and the aircraft were assembled in relatively short order. But that, of course, is very late in the campaign. The Battle of Endau, I'll talk to that in a moment. 9th of February, the last squadron, 488 squadron, is pulled out of Calang. They go to Sumatra and eventually Java. And so from the 9th of February, there's no more Allied air cover over Singapore. But contrary to the sort of myths, the RAF fought that whole campaign as best they could. The difficulty was they started out with penny packets, half the strength of the Japanese. Reinforcements didn't keep up their strength, obviously. And so every day, a few aircraft would go up, fight, and they would be faced with formations of 27 or 54 or 81 Japanese aircraft, and you're talking sort of four or six or eight at a time. It was never going to be a reasonable fight. And so this is some artist's illustration of the buffalo fighting an Oscar. It's rather a nice shot, possibly a bit unrealistic. The tactic by the buffalo pilots was to get as high as they could, dive down through the formation, shoot on your way through, and dive to get out away from them, and then start to climb back up to get an altitude advantage. But in looking through, there are a couple of interesting books, Buffaloes Over Singapore and Hurricanes Over Singapore. And when you actually start to add up the claims, most of which, as published there, are the probably not certified claims with cold light pre-war, but the accepted claims by the pilots. The Buffalo pilots, in 2 months of fighting, claimed about 100 Japanese aircraft. And the Hurricane pilots, in a mere 3 weeks or so, claimed about 70. So what a difference more Hurricanes might have made. Now, this painting is of the wildebeests in action at Endau. Endau, as you may recall, is on the east coast of Malaya, not far from Singapore, and the Japanese made a major landing there, not an opposed amphibious landing, essentially I'd call it an administrative landing, because the Australian troops had pulled down in that area. So they were landed unopposed, but it was a large-scale operation covered, amongst other things, by an aircraft carrier. So that's why you've got the little claw Navy fighters shown in this illustration. The British made a major effort with their remaining air force of wildebeests in daylight. They'd been flying by night previously. Blenheim bombers, some Hudsons, the available fighters that they had, and of course they got massacred by the Japanese air defences. That night off Endau, the Navy made an attack with HMAS Vampire, a destroyer, and an old World War I British destroyer, the Thanet. She was a survivor from Hong Kong. That attack didn't succeed at all. Thanet was sunk. Vampire got away just. Thanet's survivors, some struggled ashore and joined up with some Allied troops and walked to Singapore. 31 of them were rescued by a Japanese destroyer. It went in close, handed over the prisoners to the Japanese army, who promptly executed them. So the Battle of Endau, it's probably one of those occasions that a few VCs should have been awarded. But of course, it's a defeat. It's at the end of a long campaign. Nobody's feeling particularly positive towards the guys for whom it obviously was an extraordinarily heroic action. I commented about the painting of the Dyna reconnaissance aircraft and pointed out the marking on the tail. 243 Squadron RAF had some New Zealanders amongst them, and on the 10th of January, under radar control, they intercepted and shot down a diner. Apparently it was only at 9,000 feet, which suggested either the aircraft had some trouble or they were so complacent they didn't think they needed a higher altitude, and the two Buffaloes were able to get them. And not only did they get the diner, they retrieved the tail as a squadron souvenir. So on the 7th of January, things are not going well for the Brits. They're halfway down Malaya and everything's going badly, and it rains. Things aren't going well on the east side of Indonesia and amongst those islands, and things aren't going well in the Philippines. The Americans have retreated to the Bataan Peninsula. And so in Washington, Churchill and Roosevelt and the High Command form the first Allied command area of the war. And this was it, stretching from Burma through to New Guinea. General Wavell was plucked out of India and put in command of it. And his remark was allegedly, "I've heard of being handed the baby, but this is being handed twins." So he set up his headquarters on Java, tried to encourage the British command in Malaya, and tried to encourage the Dutch and the rest of the East Indies. And he argued that, in fact, Burma really belonged to India, and ultimately Burma, after it had fallen to the Japanese, was given back for command purposes to the British in India. Abda is really notable as being the first of the great Allied combined commands. And that brings us to the land campaign. And pretty obviously, things don't go well. Now, this is the order of battle. There were three British combat divisions available, two from the Indian Army, and typically in the Indian Army divisions there would be one-third British, as in English-Scottish units, and two-thirds Indian, as in ethnic Indian citizens in their units. The Indian units also were very dependent on British officers who'd been in India long enough that they knew the language, the multiple languages. The Australians were relatively newly arrived under the command of General Gordon Bennett, who was convinced that if he attacked, he would have this sorted. There were fortress troops, obviously, with the coastal defence guns, the anti-aircraft guns, the great store areas. And I should make a point about that when, in 1939, the British said that Singapore needed to be able to hold out for 6 months, that gave them authority, or Treasury agreed that they should start purchasing stores in Singapore and Malaya for a six-month period. So the army had great storage areas with all the sort of consumables that an army needs, from spare vehicles to rubber tyres to ammunition, you name it, it was in storage there. So oddly enough, throughout Malaya, the Japanese were going to inherit a great wealth of British army stores. And at the bottom, I've noted that the reinforcements, a whole British division and two brigades from the Indian Army. And on the Japanese side, three combat divisions, tank regiments, but they had also studied, obviously, the terrain. There were 250 bridges between North Malaya and Singapore, and so their engineer units had bridging equipment ready to replace any and all of those bridges. Notwithstanding that the British were to blow bridges, the Japanese had them repaired and replaced in very short order. And so this is an outline of the land campaign. And the point here is that on the east coast, that's the subsidiary effort. That is not the main effort. They did, however, march down the east coast, taking the various towns, airfields, radar stations and the like. The main effort is on the west coast. And as you can see, they cross from Thailand, and there are three areas where there are major attempts to stop the Japanese. The very first was to be called Operation Matador, and the idea there was, on seeing that the Japanese were coming, the British would advance into Thailand, put up defensive positions on the beaches of Singora and Patani, and prevent the Japanese from landing at all. But that wasn't acceptable to the diplomats. Churchill didn't want to upset the Japanese. Nobody wanted to send them into Thailand on a false alarm. There was much toing and froing, a lot of indecisiveness, and that never happened, sadly. So Jitra, which you'll see in the very north of Malaya, was the first effort to stop the Japanese in a pitched battle. It ended very rapidly in the rain, and a defeat of the Indian units involved. So they started falling back. Pretty soon they realised they couldn't hold the island of Penang, and that became one of the first public controversies, because the British evacuated the European citizens but not the Chinese citizens. Now the Chinese have no great love for the Japanese, and they know what's been going on in China over the last 5 years or so. So the Chinese were rather embittered by that. So Jitra is the first opportunity. The area of Kampa in the middle of Malaya is the second opportunity, and that's on the Slim River. And then when that doesn't work, they retreat down to Jemas, the area of Malacca towards the bottom, Jemas and Mua. And that's the third effort to stop the Japanese. It too doesn't go well. Now here, a Japanese unit. They came with bicycles. They promptly stole bicycles, or you know, requisitioned bicycles if they found them. They clattered down the roads of Malaya on bicycles. So while the Japanese were familiar with jungle fighting, you advanced down the road. When you reached a roadblock or a point where you need to disperse for the engagement, then you left the road, went into the jungle, outflanked the enemy and fought. That was their essential tactic. It was a blindingly obvious one. Not all the British units or Australian units learned it. The bicycles had another unintended psychological effect further down in the campaign, when their tyres were worn out and they were just riding on their rims. 600 cyclists on an asphalt road with no rubber tyres sounds like a tank advancing. And that the Indian troops particularly had not been indoctrinated into how do you cope with tanks. And here are the Japanese tanks, which compared with German, British or American tanks are not much chop, but when they're the only tanks in the theatre, they're the king. So this is a light tank. The small turret is a one-man turret, so the commander fires the gun, conducts his reconnaissance and does everything on his own. There's a driver, a machine gunner in the hull of the light tank. And this is the medium tank, and its equivalent, you'll know perhaps the American M3 Stuart, or the Honey tank of World War II, very equivalent to that, except it's got a bigger 57mm gun. But at the Slim River, a column of these tanks, and the Japanese are trained to fight at night, started before dawn, went through a Gurkha position, went through several other positions, and in fact, the Slim River, where the British were preparing for a major stand, this column of tanks pretty much sliced them open in very short order, causing a lot of panic, a lot of casualties. And the column, of course, is followed up by Japanese infantry. And Slim River is one of the first recorded accounts of the Japanese coming across wounded Allied prisoners and promptly bayoneting or shooting them. Anti-tank guns, the Australians had them, proved to be very good at GMAS. And this is a photo from the time. I think it was a Life magazine photographer who took this. The 2-pounder British anti-tank gun was a good anti-tank gun for its time, and against the Japanese tanks was more than capable. You can also sense the close range that they would fight at. This is one of the Japanese medium tanks. A curious thing about this particular tank is that you can see there's a hull machine gunner down in the hull with this machine gun pointing forward. The 57mm gun is pointing to the right. At the top, the two parts of the hatch are open, but at the left, on the back of the turret, is a machine gun. And so the two men who squeezed into that turret, one had to operate the 57mm gun firing in this direction, and the other had a machine gun firing behind them. Rather odd circumstances. A tank, and it was the only one ever built like that. But again, that particular one didn't survive the Australians. Lieutenant Colonel Anderson, an Australian, earned a VC for his part. His unit got surrounded. He joined up with an Indian unit. They had to go as best they could overland against various roadblocks to try and get away from the Japanese. They didn't, and in the end, he ordered his columns to disperse and go through the jungle and find their own way through the jungle, through the swamps, into Johor. That happened. He survived. Got a VC, was a prisoner of war. The sad thing was, he too realised that in a situation they could only leave their critically injured, wounded behind. And of the 200 or so wounded Aussies and Indians, only two men survived the subsequent massacre, but one of them was able to give evidence at the Tokyo war crimes. So the terribly mixed feelings about that. Not Anderson's fault, of course, he earned his VC. And so that brings us to February 1942, and the Japanese have conquered Malaya and are down at the Johor Straits, and they're ready to take on Singapore, the alleged fortress. And this is where we run into the problem of General Percival, the general officer commanding, who didn't want to upset anybody by building defensive positions. So when the troops withdrew to Singapore, on the north shore of Singapore, there were no prepared defensive positions. Percival was also convinced that the Japanese would attack from the eastern side, and you might be able to see the northern area, 18 British Division and 11 Indian Division. The naval base up here, which of course was being bombed and shelled, and the British were burning the oil in the fuel tanks. Percival was focused on the east side. He put the Australians, the survivors of the 8th Division, on the western side, and that's where the Japanese attacked. And so there was a week of heavy fighting as the Japanese drove in from the west and basically reached the main road down to the city and eventually invested the whole city. And at that point, with no access to water, no support obviously from of Allied reinforcements coming by sea, the Japanese had already landed in Sumatra, so they were kind of cut off there. At that point, General Percival surrendered. This is a painting based on a photo the Japanese took of the surrender. Percival in the middle there, looking to over his left shoulder, and Yamashita in the middle with the arm across his chest, insisting that they surrender straight away. And the Japanese language newspaper of the time, there's an hour and a half time difference. The surrender was 8:30 Singapore time, 10 o'clock Tokyo time. And of course, this is the Japanese situation in 1942, as you'll be familiar, because simultaneously with the Malay campaign, Burma is under attack, the Netherlands, East Indies are the target, as I said, the Philippines. The siege at Bataan and Corregidor was still going on, and they had a large chunk of the Pacific. Now, there's just a couple of points in summary of the impact of the whole thing. So firstly, there was no Dunkirk from Singapore. From about the 12th of February onwards, the Japanese naval air force came back into action and sank ships at a great rate of knots as they were sailing out of Singapore. There are, as you might be aware, some horrific stories. One naval officer won a VC posthumously, but the Japanese very deliberately ensured there was no equivalent to Dunkirk. The occupation of Singapore and Malaya was harsh, and the Japanese particularly went after the Chinese citizens of the area, it was essentially ethnic cleansing. They went after every man of military age. Chinese citizen, ethnic Chinese citizens of Singapore have not forgotten the Japanese occupation, nor, of course, as you know, China itself has not forgotten the Japanese occupation. Prisoners of war. The Japanese were a bit shocked as to how many prisoners of war they had taken, because the defending army of Singapore was numerically stronger than the attacking army. the Indian prisoners, they put under a lot of pressure to join an Indian national army and fight the British colonial oppressors. Some did, to a matter of some, a turn of some thousands, they fought in Burma. There was, of course, forced labour and the infamous Burma Railway. I don't know if back in the days we were allowed to travel, if any of you had been to Thailand, but if you go to southern Thailand, they will show you the Hellfire Pass and the other areas that the prisoners labelled on, and the River Kwai is still there, the railway is still there, and the modern bridge that has replaced the bridge over the River Kwai is still there. But I'm not sure that the railway into Burma is used particularly. If you didn't go to the Burma Railway as a prisoner, you might wind up just breaking rocks on Changi to build the Changi Airfield. So what is now Changi International Airport, underneath it, some of the rocks and runways that the prisoners built for the Japanese. And other prisoners, of course, were transported to Japan to work there. The ships they went in were unmarked, not advised to the Allies. So several of the prisoner transport ships were, of course, promptly sunk by American submarines, to whom they were just, as far as they knew, legitimate targets. However, the Japanese did achieve that the colonised peoples overall lost respect, whether in French Indochina, in Malaya, Indonesia, or India itself. And, of course, there was a great wave of independence movements post-war. And as a final note, that if you go to Singapore, they have quite a number of memorials to the campaign, and they too haven't forgotten the impact of the Japanese occupation. And so that, I've taken a bit too much time there, but that completes my talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Very interesting. We do have time for questions, so please fire away. Yeah.
Was the fall of Singapore inevitable, or was it incompetence, or was it going to happen anyway because of the wider geopolitical and strategic situation?
I think it was inevitable once the scale of the Japanese attack had become apparent. If you look at Bataan and Corregidor in the Philippines, the Americans held out until May 1942, but there was no way with the Japanese conquests further into the Pacific and of all the East Indies that the Americans could reinforce the Philippines. Well, if Singapore had held for any longer, once Sumatra and Java had gone, there's no way the Brits could actually reinforce Singapore. There was a huge inevitability of it. But I think the shocking thing is the speed at which it happened, and then the not only incompetence, but there was backbiting, disagreement. The British High Command is a textbook example of just how not to do it. One chap was too old. Percival himself was apparently a very good staff officer. Notwithstanding that he'd been in France and Britain, he hadn't seen direct action or field command in action. And there was a sense that he was always waiting to be tapped by the directing staff and told, yes, you're doing the right thing. And then when he had General Wavell in position telling him, well, this is the right thing to do in Singapore, you know, they're going to come from the west, he still didn't do it. So Percival had a number of professional problems. He was probably one of those people who probably would have been best as a colonel on somebody else's staff. Yeah. So there's a lot of... And ultimately, you see, Churchill himself, firstly, he put a huge effort from June 1941 in sending supplies to Russia. And it's perfectly understandable. You didn't, you know, it looked as though Russia was going to be defeated. But he was either blasé or just underestimated that the Japanese could attack. And they, notwithstanding the good intelligence, back in that sort of August, September time frame when it would have been time to reinforce Singapore, they were they didn't make those dispositions, and they didn't. They accepted that things, you know, they'd made a decision about the Brewster Buffalo fighter, so that's good enough for them. Whereas, in fact, the Japanese Air Force was a lot superior. So there are a lot of factors at play at the grand strategic level, as well as down to the basically the general officer commanding and that high command level. When you read the stories of the unit, pretty much all of them are of heroic soldiers, hard-working junior officers, and people certainly doing their duty. But the sad thing of that, then, is that it's the junior officers, the battalion commanders, etc., are the ones who get shot. I alluded to the Indian divisions. When your Urdu-speaking British officer gets shot and there's no replacement, it throws the whole unit into chaos. So there were a lot of those issues, but at the ordinary soldier level, you read and you weep about some of these stories. You know, they tried hard.
Time for one more before we have to get out. Any others?
There were no plans to invade Australia in the initial plans.
No, I don't think the Japanese army was never keen on the idea of invading Australia. Although I'm told that, the Japanese may well have printed an occupation currency for places like Australia. But no, there was no definite plan to... the Japanese army wanted to fight in China. Everything else was just in order to get them oil so they could fight in China.
The Fort Moresby would have been the last call.
The furthest that they went, yes. They did want to take New Caledonia and Fiji and therefore cut off Australia from American reinforcement.
New Caledonia was a resources issue because of precious metals, but I think Fiji was just a bit too far.
New Caledonia was
Fiji. Until the Australians turned up with a cruiser in mid-1941 and said, come on, chaps. we did the same incidentally in Tahiti, but apparently they gave our sailors a very friendly welcome. The Japanese war plan was quite limited, and everything was coloured by the fact that the war in China was actually for the army, their prime business. And yet they managed to unleash the Pacific War, which led to their destruction. Yeah.
But didn't they get the Kokoda Trail and also bomb Darwin? So there must have been some tension there, wouldn't there?
Oh, yes, they were perfectly happy to bomb Australia, which they did. Yes. No, Japanese Air Forces, Army and Navy Air Forces, certainly knew the value in attacking other people's harbours and supply lines and all that. So, yes, Australia was very much under attack. But there was no coherent plan to invade.
There was no invasion plan per se.
No.
I think the bombing campaign was really to take out ports and lines of supply, lines of communication, because Americans were using Darwin quite extensively. I mean, the number of ships in port there. Also, it was an Australian naval base, so it was quite significant. Yeah.
Did force the submarines which were based in Darwin out
of
Fremantle, which is a major submarine based in...
Yes, that's right.
Groom and Darwin.
Yeah. Now, American submarines were based on both the east and the west coast, yes, and Fremantle was a major one, yeah. I recall listening to one American submarine commander, or I guess he was a submarine officer, that his particular submarine deployed from Pearl Harbor, did the war patrol in the Philippines area, and then sailed for Fremantle. So, it didn't have to make the long haul back to Pearl Harbor. So, yes, Fremantle was a major base, that's true. Yeah. Now, when I say the Japanese didn't want to invade, it doesn't downplay Australia's position and role in the whole campaign, not at all. But it wasn't in their war aims. And the Japanese army didn't cooperate with the Navy about a possible invasion.
Sorry, there was just one more point.
With the attack on Singapore, the Japanese took care, to be the right word, to avoid damaging the infrastructure of the city and area?
I don't think taking care is quite the right word.
Quite a bit of
damage. Yeah, their tactic was high-level bombing, and they would bomb in a formation. But yes, they primarily went after the harbour where the troop ships were, or the naval base, and they had good pre-war intelligence. They knew where the coast defences were. So they went after military targets. But if those military targets happened to be in the vicinity of Singapore City, it didn't hurt that they were bombing houses and shops and whatnot, which they did. They didn't try and raise the cities itself. A lot of the buildings survived, but their bombing was very much focused on the available military targets. Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, look, I think we'd better bring it to a close there. So once again, Richard, thanks very much, and please put your hands together.